welcome to another episode of the Conversations with Authors podcast. I'm your host, Alison Thompson, aka The Proof Fairy, and in each episode of this podcast, I get to talk to an author about what inspired them to start writing and what tips they would give other aspiring authors. My guest today is Mose J. Gingrich. Mose spent the first 23 years of his life in the Amish community before heading to LA and becoming a reality TV star. Now he's married with kids and spends his days as a big rig trucker and his evenings writing murder mysteries set in the Amish community. As well as giving an insight into the life of an author, this episode also shines a light on the culture of the Amish as told by someone who knows them inside out. I really hope you enjoy it. Hello, Mose. It's really lovely to meet you today. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Well, hello, Alison. It's great to be on here.
Oh, thank you. It's the first time I've spoken to anyone in Missouri, so this is a first for me.
It is my first podcast ever. This is a learning curve for me. So, yeah, absolutely.
I'll be very gentle.
I've done quite a bit of television work. I've done quite a bit of recording, but I've never done this. So we'll learn together.
We will, definitely, definitely. And I've done a few of these, so I should be doing a better job than I'm doing already. But it's a Saturday. I don't ever record podcasts on a Saturday. I mean, I'm in weekend mode. That's what it is. Anyway,
yes.
Yeah. So tell me about your books.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, going back to during our exchange previously, did you pick up on the fact that I came from an Amish background? And are you familiar with the Amish?
I am a little bit from programs on TV. So maybe I know you have been in programs on TV about the Amish community. So, yeah.
Yeah. If you would have, you might have recognized me, but yeah, I was the first, as far as I know, I was the first to ever do Amish television shows, reality shows and documentaries. And that launched into, there's quite a few that came after, but I started doing those and I've now been out of the Amish for 20 years and okay. I've done about 30 episodes total of 31 hour episodes of Amish television on the Amish lifestyle, the transition into the outside world, how difficult it can be to transition into the outside world. And you don't exist. Like you literally don't exist when you leave the Amish. You no social security numbers, no driver's license, no credit score, none of that stuff. Wow. And it was really odd when I was Amish, the Amish have such a good reputation. I could walk into a bank and just sit down and say, well, I'm Mose Gingrich. My dad has several loans with you guys for farms. And that was enough for me to get a loan. They didn't need to run any credit. There was no credit to run. You just walk in and, okay, well, I know your dad. If you don't make your payments, your dad will. Yeah, so when I left the Amish, that's one of the first things. I walked into a bank and I told them my name and, hey, I'm here to buy a house. And it didn't get very far. You know? They didn't know my dad. So that's just one of the things. But no, I left the Amish because they are very secluded. They don't do anything higher than an eighth grade education. And the whole concept is, if you're going to be farming or working in a sawmill or furniture making, you don't need higher than an eighth grade education. Why would you? You don't need to learn how to use a computer. You don't need to know anything about technology. And I wanted to go further in life. There's so much more outside the Amish than just that. And I wanted to go further and do so much more, but I was never going to be able to do that had I stayed Amish. And so I spent many, many years, way too long, far too long, trying to get out of the environment where I can flow freely, if you would. And finally, at 23 years old, I left. And like I said, I did a couple TV shows and the TV life wasn't for me.
That must have been very, very strange to do, having lived within the Amish community for 23 years without access to technology, without access to television, I guess, and then suddenly to be in front of the camera. That must have been quite something.
Well, I rather enjoyed that part, being in front of the camera. I'm not going to lie. Now, the first part of what you said there, if you've never known anything about technology or TV, you don't really realize what you're missing. Like I never seen a movie or a TV program or a sports game or anything like that until I was 23 years old. Wow. And you don't know what you're missing. You don't know until you see that side of it. And you're like, wait a minute, there's so much more to the world than I ever realized. So, but yes, when they took me from a small Amish community to Los Angeles, California, and put me into a massive mansion in the Hollywood Hills with a bunch of other kids, and we're like, okay, let's do a TV show. You know, every single day I saw 1,000 things I had never seen before. Just the things that would just blow your mind that you don't think about, like skyscrapers and just long black limousines and traffic jams after traffic jams. I mean, just anywhere you wanted to go, you had to, even if it was only 15 miles, you had to plan for about 3 hours because of all the traffic. And so, yeah, just a big adjustment. I did get used to the cameras very quickly. And that part I liked. I liked, there's a certain, when I left the Amish and I was ready to start my adventures, it was a nice transition to have cameras and sound crew and producers following you everywhere and telling you about the world and documenting it and make it a big deal out of the smallest things with you. That part I actually liked. And in fact, I liked it so much that when the show ended and I went back to good old Missouri, where there is nothing going on at all, the transition was much, much harder than I could have ever anticipated. You don't think about those things. Oh, yeah. You don't think about the entire time you're in front of the spotlight and they're filming you from the time you get up in the morning until you go to bed at night. Everything you do and every word you say is recorded and documented and edited. And then you go do interviews on those things. It becomes a lifestyle that you get used to very quickly. And then one day the show ends and you go back home and you wake up the next morning and there's no cameras. And in fact, there's nobody there that cares. Like I can get up and go to a restaurant at that time before the show came out. I could go to a restaurant and sit down and there was nobody there that knew me and nobody that cared that I was there. Like the adjustment was actually very depressing. You don't realize until you've done it how used to it you got to have everybody following you and monitoring every little minute detail of your life. And then it just ends and you realize, oh, wait, people didn't necessarily care that much about my life. They were making a TV show.
Right.
It's almost like a rude awakening. Like I'm not quite as special as I thought I was.
I guess with sort of LA and TV being such a huge departure from your way of life up till that point as well, it must have been quite comforting to have the people around you all that time. And then all of a sudden to be kind of thrown into the real world, maybe back in Missouri, but the real world outside the community on your own.
Yeah, a lot of TV shows, there's many things I didn't know about TV programs, but I didn't know this. I found out after our show ended. So this was back in 2004. And I found out after the show ended, they actually have therapists that they make available to the cast of TV shows, therapists you can call and talk with about your loneliness. Now, I never called a therapist, but they do make them because it's such an adjustment.
Right. Like, yeah.
I remember that first Saturday after I got home, I went to a wedding and I walked into this wedding and there's all these people. And I remember walking like through the crowd and looking around. And it was this absolute feeling of just isolation of, wait, this wedding is not about me. And I probably come across as like really self-centered and really like I need to be the center of attention. It's not necessarily that. It's just that's what I was used to. And I go to a wedding and I all of a sudden realize, oh, wait, this wedding is not about me. In fact, I am just a distant bystander watching somebody else be the center of attention. And I remember I took a walk down out through this meadow at the wedding and just like really had to have a heart-to-heart conversation with myself, like, you're not going to always be in front of a camera. Your life is not going to consist of television and celebrity status and money. You're just an average guy. You need to come to terms with that. And I was able to recognize that and adjust. And so I did TV for the next 10 to 15 years off and on. I did several TV shows. They don't pay that, like reality shows and documentaries don't pay that much money. They really don't. Like I could have made as much money at a regular job as I spent doing TV work.
Right.
But what happened by doing the TV work is I did build a fan base or an audience. I have a website, and I had a website at that time. So I've had people that have followed me and followed my TV shows. And that kind of set the ground for when I decided to write later on in life.
Okay.
I already had a kind of an established fan base that followed Moe's Gingrich, the TV star. And it has been a little bit more difficult than I thought it would be to try to transition fans of a television show into fans of books, you know?
Yeah,
I think, isn't it kind of normal though for a lot of people in the spotlight to, if they've identified themselves in one way, take Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows Tom Cruise is like this action film star, right?
Yeah.
What if Tom Cruise came out and said he wants to become a country singer?
Not
how many people would show up to his concert?
I guess the hardcore fans will follow him everywhere, whatever he does.
Right.
There'll be that sort of small group. But generally, if you don't like country music, you're not going to like country music just because it's Tom Cruise singing it. So
And I think it really comes down to how you first come onto the scene in the public spotlight, whatever your identity is at that time, that's how people will recognize and remember you.
Right.
And it's really difficult to change that identity. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what happened with me. A lot of people remember me as Moe's Gingrich, the really serious Amish guy who was searching for God and was searching for, like, part of the television show was me helping ex-Amish kids that are Amish kids that are leaving the community and helping them integrate into the outside world because they don't have anybody to help them do that. And many of them struggle, and many of them get into drugs and alcohol and really bad habits because they start losing hope. And the transition is much harder than they thought it was going to be. And so my role kind of became taking these kids in and helping them get established and in the outside world. Mm-hmm. And we made a TV show about that. And so a lot of people knew me as like Moe's Gingrich, the serious, good-hearted guy who gives his life and money to help these Amish kids. Well, then I turned around, and when I finally decided to start writing, what I read does not follow that at all. I read murder mystery thrillers.
Yep.
And crime. And it's and I love it. Like those are Stephen King. I mean, the more scared you can make me, the happier I am reading a book, right?
Right. Yeah.
So if that's all you read, then naturally that's what you're gonna want to write.
Yeah.
And so when I started writing, there are several barriers I had to try to break, or what do they say, glass ceilings I had to shatter when I got into the writing world. And one of them was exactly that. People that perceive me as Moe's Gingrich, the serious Amish guy searching for religion or searching for God or searching for a deeper meaning in life. Oh, wait, now this Moe's Gingrich is trying to write murder mystery, and he's using fictitious Amish characters to create murder mystery plots and scenes, and people could not connect the dots. It was much harder than I thought it was going to be. So that was the first thing. But the second thing is there's already a massive, massive market out there for Amish fiction literature.
Okay.
If you've seen one Amish fiction book cover, you've seen them all.
Okay.
The
outside with the hat world, woman with a kind of apron or something.
Well, let me describe the typical Amish book cover for you.
Okay.
The perception outside people that have never been Amish, the perception they have largely because of books, is every Amish fiction book, or maybe not every, but like probably 85 to 90% of all Amish fiction books that are written are fluffy romance.
Right.
And there's always on the cover this beautiful girl with this lovely, pleasant smile, this Amish girl with a bonnet and bonnet strings like blowing in the wind, and she's dancing in a flowery meadow. And there's like this tan muscular guy in the background with this weird grin on his face, or I guess handsome grin on his face. I don't know. And he's got a piece of straw sticking out of his mouth. And he's chewing on a piece of straw, and yeah. You know what's going to happen. They're going to fight, and then they're going to get together and live happily ever after.
Yeah.
And that's what, when people pick up an Amish fiction book, that's what they want to read. They want to get lost in a world of wholesomeness and bliss and no problems, no drama. Mm-hmm. That's what they perceive the Amish to be.
Yeah.
So there's a glass ceiling that I'm trying to break that is impossible. Every literary agent I ever approached, every publishing house I approach is like, your writing's really good, but nobody wants to read Amish fiction murder mystery novels.
Okay.
Without trying it,
that's a shame, isn't it? Because
yeah.
Who knows?
I mean,
it might be a whole new audience that would love that, but unless you try it.
And that's the thing is, then at some point, I have published the first book in 2021 and in 2022, in a month, in June of 2022, mm-hmm. I will publish book two. There, the audience is growing and it's a series, but at some point I have to decide, am I going to continue doing what my heart tells me to do and what I'm good at and keep writing murder mystery and keep banging my head against the wall every time somebody picks it up and is looking to read a fluffy romance novel and they're disappointed? Or at some point, do I sell out and write fluffy romance because that's what sells?
It's
one of those really tough decisions. It's like, do you write what sells? I'm sure musicians run into that when they're doing music. My heart tells me I want to put out this type of music, but that's not mainstream media and it's not going to do as well. And the crowds aren't going to be as big. So do I do what I don't want to do for marketing and publicity and, you know, so yeah, that's definitely been something I've been running into. In fact, I've had readers of fluffy romance novels contact me almost upset. Like, what are you doing? This is not how the Amish are at all. Like, because I should probably say that on top of murder mystery, when I talk about actual intimate Amish details, let's say secret church meetings where the preachers get together and make decisions for the church, for the betterment of the church, or they decide to discipline a member who did something wrong in church, those are not always pleasant meetings. And when I was Amish, they were not pleasant meetings. Okay. Those meetings are hardcore, almost dictator style meetings, like do this or you will get excommunicated. There's no fluff and there's no romance.
Right.
And it's not lighthearted at all. They're deep and they're intimidating, and you don't leave those meetings feeling good about the experience.
Yeah.
So those make it into my books as well.
Right. Whereas the fluffy romances are presenting a potentially true look at the Amish as being these innocent, peaceful farmland people, countryside people with their religion and falling in love. But there's a darker side as well. And that's what you're bringing.
The fluffy romance novels are a fantasy that doesn't even exist.
Right. Okay.
And the outside world doesn't know that because the Amish are a secretive society that stays apart from the outside world. And so many of these non-Amish people have never been in an Amish community. They've never stepped inside an Amish home. All they know is the fluffy romance they've read.
Yeah.
I never, in my entire time in the Amish community, I never saw fluff or romance. It was nothing but hard work and a group of preachers that set the rules, and you had to follow the rules. And if you didn't, you were disciplined for it. So while my books have lighthearted moments in them or entire lighthearted chapters in them, I feel like my books are a lot more authentic about what the Amish lifestyle is like than what the fluffy romance are.
Right.
Am I doing the right thing by writing authentic books the way I grew up? I think I am, because that's what the lifestyle is really about. Why would you put out some fake fluffy fantasy that doesn't exist? That's not what I grew up with.
I can see why there's that conflict then. So people want to believe in this community being,
of course,
absolutely. And you're putting out these murder mystery stories set in the community that's actually much more like it it is in reality through your experience of living in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't want to see that. They kind of don't want to believe that, I guess.
They don't want to believe it. They feel like I'm betraying the Amish culture or the Amish lifestyle by writing a little bit darker or a little bit more not as fluffy. And yeah. I've had readers contact me and tell me that, like, why are you doing this? Why are your books not as lighthearted and you know, like, you know what you're writing is not true. And I don't say this because it would be very unprofessional, but I want to say, have you ever been in an Amish community?
Yeah.
Because most of them haven't. And right. I have. Yeah. I grew up there for 23 years. And I left because I wanted more. I'm not going to say I left because I didn't like the lifestyle, because there were many, many things about the Amish lifestyle I did like. Mm-hmm. But I left because I wanted even more than what I was growing up with. I didn't leave because I loved the lifestyle. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah.
So no, but no, I absolutely enjoy writing, and you are a writer as well. So you could probably relate to a few things that I say here, but isn't there something absolutely addictive to writing? If you've had a plot or an idea or a fantasy brewing in your mind for a while and you can't quite get it right, that one time when everything goes right, you're well rested, no dogs barking, nobody bothering you, and you can just sit down and churn out this entire chapter, and you get done and you're like, that was really good.
Oh gosh, yes. Yeah, sometimes it can be a real struggle, can't it? Sometimes you sit there and it just doesn't come, and you try and bash some words out, but they're not there. And then there's those other times when, yeah, you have that idea, you sit down, you put your fingers to the keyboard, and you just write, and the world disappears around you as the story comes out. And it's quite a magical moment to get to sort of lose yourself in, I think, when that happens.
Those moments when everything flows and you know it's good and you know somebody's going to read it and be inspired by it, those are the moments I think writers live for.
I think so. Yeah.
It's now the problem with
adrenaline kick, dopamine kick, whatever it is it does to your head, that's what you crave, isn't it?
I feel like it's better than about any drug out there. my list of drugs I've tried are very small or non-existent, but it is a very addictive feeling.
Definitely. Yeah. And when your book arrives as well, when you give birth to it, that book arrives and you hold it in your hands and it's actually there. That stuff that was in your head is there on paper. And
absolutely.
This is it. That's quite a special moment.
So the discrepancy is this. So we all love those moments when everything goes right, and you can almost trick your brain into thinking, well, I'm just going to wait to write until I have those moments. Those moments are so rare. You will never get a book written if you decide to do just that. Like, you literally have to approach writing as a job, and you have to write when you're depressed, when you're tired, when you're hungry. When somebody has made you mad, you still have to sit down and get something down, or the book will never get written.
That's like, right. Yeah.
In short, if you're only going to wait to write when you're inspired, you'll never get a book done.
No, that's right. I mean, I wrote two books last year. I wrote my second nonfiction book, and then I wrote a novel, which I haven't edited yet. So at some stage I'll go back I keep bracing myself to go back and read it, because I just don't want it to not be as good as I remember. But I got myself in the habit of every morning, 9 o'clock, made a cup of tea, sat down and wrote for an hour. And that was my way of doing it. And some days I really didn't want to do it, and I'd be looking up at the clock all the time and, oh, only 10 minutes to go, you know. And other days the words just flowed. But if I hadn't sat down every day and done that, I wouldn't have got the book done. Because the times that you feel like doing it, the times that you're inspired and that it feels right, there aren't enough of them to get the book finished. And
absolutely,
the kind of flow that you need to have with a book. I mean, you can't write a chapter every 3 months when inspiration takes you, can it?
Right. And frankly, sometimes when you sit there and you're forcing it and everything feels like it's coming out forced and wrong and nothing is clicking and it just feels like you're wasting your time, you can sometimes come back the next day after letting that set overnight. You can come back the next day and read it, and you're like, there's actually parts of this that are pretty good. You can go through and edit it and actually turn it into a pretty good chapter before you gave up on it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you can't edit nothing, can you? You have to have something to edit. And even if something is not very good, at least you've got something to work from.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes what happens if I'm really struggling with a chapter and I've tried 3 or 4 different times and it's just not coming together and I know it's not very good. You're right. Try again, because what you're doing is subconsciously in your mind, you're creating ways the chapter can't work. And eventually you will find a structure that will work for the chapter. But if you just sit back and just don't try, you'll never reach that point where it works.
No, that's right. That's right.
For me, perhaps my writing style and my writing times are the epitome of like really having to work hard to make it happen. And here's why. I am a delivery truck driver.
Okay.
And I'm gone all week and I drive for 11 hours a day.
Wow. Yeah.
So if you've driven for 11 hours a day and then you have to try to write at night, you know how mush your brain is after 11 hours of focusing on the road and traffic and
I can't people, even imagine. Yeah.
People cutting you off every day and just busy traffic and towns and accidents. And then 11 hours a day. And then at night I get parked. And so I did that for the first 3 or 4 months that I was writing, I struggled that I get parked and I just try to force myself to, maybe I drink an energy drink or drink a cup of coffee to try to get any kickstart going and write for an hour or so before I fell asleep, just plain from fatigue. And I finally had to readjust the way I was looking at it. And I started just, I realized if I get up a lot earlier in the morning, like 5, which is too early for anybody, especially a writer.
Yeah.
but if you get up, I mean, we're all night owls, right? We'd all love to sleep in until like 10 or 11 in the morning and then write late at night. Like that's, maybe that's not true for everybody, but for me,
yeah,
my time that I'm humming is like from 4 in the afternoon till like 9 at night.
Okay. Yeah.
So what I started doing is I started getting up at 5 in the morning and I'd drive my 11 hours and I'd be parked by about 4:30 in the evening. Okay. And then I'd lay down and take a nap and reset my mind, because by that time in the evening, your brain is full of so many thoughts about just worries and troubles and how am I going to pay my bills and just life worries. And your brain is cluttered. But if you lay down and take a nap, your brain seems to kind of reset. And when you wake back up, don't touch your phone, leave your phone alone. So, you know, your brain doesn't get recluttered, because as soon as you start on that phone, you're going to be on it for a while.
Oh yeah.
I'd wake up at like six at night and I get out of my truck because I sleep in my truck. So I'd get out of my truck and I'd run for a mile or two to get the blood pumping, get the adrenaline going. And I'd come back after running for a mile or so, I'd come back and I could sit down and write very solid material for about 2 or 3 hours before I was
okay. Wow. Yeah.
And that was a life changer for me. When I started writing at night in the sleeper of my truck, that was a game changer for me. The quality of my writing immediately began to become a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? Everyone has their own way of doing it. Everyone has their own kind of golden hour or time when it works for them. And it's just playing around with your lifestyle when your most active time is and finding that time that works for you.
Well, I think a lot of people, there's a misconception for readers. A lot of readers, when they read a book, they just assume, well, that person made it as a writer, so they have a bunch of money and they write full time and like they're rich and famous and live in this mansion somewhere. And they don't realize that many of us have jobs. Writing makes a little bit of money, but it doesn't make enough money to pay the bills.
Yeah.
You still have to do jobs on the side to make money. And somewhere outside of your normal job, you have to find time to still write on top.
That's right. Yeah.
Normal job.
I think I've interviewed around 80 writers for this podcast. And I think of those 80 writers, one is a full-time writer And I don't think he would describe himself as rich anyway.
Yeah. So make no mistake about it. If I had a choice of being a delivery truck driver or a full-time writer, I would kick the delivery trucking to the curb in a heartbeat. Give me a cabin in the woods on a mountain in the pines with a stream or a river flowing past and let me write full-time. Dude, I will churn out material like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. But you know, we can all dream, right?
Yeah, we all have bills to pay. So your first book is Shadows We Remain.
Yes.
And then you've got the second one, Caroline Creek Chaos, coming out next month. So how did you get that first book published? After you said you did a lot of banging your head against publishers' doors and nobody wanted it. Did you sell?
Yeah, so even that process, you've gone through this process, so you know the frustrations. Mm-hmm. You've spent so much time. I kind of described just now the process of how difficult it is to drive for 11 hours and get motivated to run at night just so you can write for 2 or 3 hours. When you do all that and you've come up with these fictitious characters and these fictitious settings and plots and murder and mystery, all the gory stuff, and you mesh it all together into a thing called a book, and you're proud of it. Like, you're proud of it. You've done this. Like, I've done this. This is a glorious accomplishment. The world is not going to be able to keep their hands off of this, you know. And then you
real hope. Yeah.
Right.
Everybody's going to buy my book. Everyone. Oh,
absolutely. Like, you don't even have to market it or advertise it. Just put it out there and people are going to tell each other about it. And it's going to be a smashing bestseller. And then you send it out to the first few literary agents. And by the way, when you go to their websites, have you noticed how they all seem like they're talking to you? Like, I'm looking for a murder mystery with rare characters or characters with underrepresented backgrounds. You've seen it a million times. Mm-hmm, you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, they're talking directly to me. They want me.
Yeah.
And you send it to them and you either never hear from them or it's rejection after rejection after rejection. And that part is so frustrating because, when I first started, I didn't research any of this. I just assumed when you get done, you just approach a literary agent and they say yes, and you get it published and that's it. And you don't
realize, you buy your cabin in the woods and you're set for
life. Yeah, you know, and you don't realize that actually getting a literary agent to even accept your manuscript. Mm-hmm. And once they've accepted it, for them to find a publishing house that'll accept it, the process is so much more daunting and difficult than you think. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what I ended up doing is I tracked it, obviously. I'm sure most writers do, but I tracked it and I contacted 35 literary agents. My response ratio was really, really good. And I think I probably even there had an advantage because I have been on television and I do come from kind of a rare Amish background. There are people that are interested in the Amish lifestyle. So I'm sure that alone gave me an advantage most writers will never get. Literary agents actually opened my email and read what I wrote because they wanted to hear more. So out of the 35, I ultimately had 11 responses. Out of the 11 responses, I had 3 that were willing to publish my book.
Okay.
And I'm sure out of that, that's a massive ratio. I'm sure most writers never hear from literary agents or never get accepted. And so my ratio, although it seemed really frustrating and low, was probably higher than most. Mm-hmm. Then I kind of work backwards. I should have probably done all this before I contacted the literary agents. But once I received those acceptances, I started really digging into them. Like, who have you published before? How successful were those authors? And in almost every case, probably 9 out of every 10 authors they work with didn't make it as writers, or they just didn't do great. And it was like, I think I could probably do better on my own.
Yeah. Why give them a huge, or pretty much all of the profits from my writing?
Yeah.
If they're not actually going to promote me to.
And all the control. Author.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the control.
Yes. Yeah.
And they can drop you really quick, or just like you said, not promote you. If your first book is not a smashing bestseller, they're going to stop investing in you and your time, and they're going to pick an author that does. Yeah. And you can't control any of that. And so based on the fact that I had done some television shows and things in the past, after I very seriously discussed going with the one literary agent, and may still do that in the future because they seem really nice.
Yeah.
Just not as big as I wanted them to be. I wanted bigger. Like, why would you not want to go as big as you can go?
True. Very true.
And so ultimately I ended up self-publishing. I'm self-published and I'm going to take that route on this entire series. And after this series is over, I'm going to see if I can build up my own audience to the level that I want to be. And, you know, just going through the other things that most readers probably don't realize about writers is, if we could just invest our entire spare time into just writing, what a glorious career that would be.
Yeah.
But you have to put so much time into marketing
and
advertising, researching, book cover designs, book formatting, finding editors. Where do you find a good editor that cares about your book? You know, all those things. And, you don't realize how much time and money goes into those things. Mm-hmm. And once you've invested all that time, energy, and money into getting your book prepared, how many volumes of your book do you actually have to sell just to break even? The amount is unbelievable. But I'm going to stick with it and see how well I can do on my first series. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to stick with what I've been writing. I'm not going to sell out to fluffy romance just yet. I'm going to give it everything I got in the first series. And once I'm done with the first series, then I'm going to sit back and reevaluate and say, okay, do I actually want to go with the literary agent at a publishing house? And do I need to sell fluffy romance? And mm-hmm. is it worth it for me to write what's not in my heart just so I can make it as a writer? Like I'll reevaluate, but I'm not in a rush. I'm not in a rush to do that. I'm gonna write what I want to write first, and then I'll reevaluate at that point.
No, that's good. Yeah. So presumably your book's out on Kindle, paperback,
Amazon. If you go to Amazon, search for me, or you can go to my website.
You mentioned before we went live with this, you mentioned that you'd recently soundproofed a room in your house for something to do with your books. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I'm always, once you decide to commit to self-publishing, then another thing that goes into the marketing and all that, and the reason you and I are talking, podcasts. Mm-hmm. Podcasts are a big deal to get the word out there and let people know you've written a book. But at some point I decided, people have always told me, well, Mose, you have a voice for radio, or you have a narrating voice. Okay. I decided to start recording my own audiobooks. Why not?
Gosh.
If I already have the voice to do it, why not do my own narrating? And in the basement of my house, I created a soundproof room. I do have a broad background of construction, so that part was pretty easy for me to just kind of research how to do soundproofing and soundproof walls and soundproof floors and blankets on my walls so your voice doesn't echo or bounce off the walls, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I created it and I started narrating, and I ran into a few issues. Again, you have to hire a sound engineer that engineers your audio.
Wow.
Because whether you think you do this or not, there are little smacks of the lips while you're talking. You may breathe too deep, or you may breathe too much through your nose, or click your tongue too much, or pause too long, or whatever. And audio engineers, you can hire audio engineers for pretty affordable prices that go in and edit all that stuff out. But the one thing they cannot edit is if you have weaknesses in your narrating. And guess what I did not see coming?
Okay.
You would never think this until you try to narrate a book yourself. I was pretty good at just normal narrating a scene. Mm-hmm. The woods were dark, the trees were blowing, the leaves were whatever. But then you get to dialogue between two people. All of a sudden I had to speak the tone inflection of two men, but I had to change one. They can't be exactly identical.
Right. Yeah.
Bruce said, "Let's meet at the restaurant and eat lunch." "Okay," said Stan. You know, there has to be two different voices there.
Yeah. And I guess you're not making up, you're not talking in a funny, you're not doing an impression, you're not talking in a funny accent or anything.
Yeah. And you need to
tone them so they're different, so they come across as different as real people. Yeah.
And you think if you have a good voice for narrating, those things come natural. And I don't think they do. I bet you even the best narrators out there had to really work on their craft of different voices and different pitches. But then you get to, now I have to have a conversation between a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
My voice is not exactly a woman voice. My voice, how do you go from... Well, I don't know. Would you like to join me at lunch this afternoon? I would. You know, how do you say that as a woman? Do you try to take the part out of your voice and almost kind of whisper it like a woman doesn't whisper always, you know?
No. Hello.
Exactly.
I was imagining those romantic books. I would imagine there's a lot of whispering going on, actually.
Probably.
Yeah.
but so I started running into issues with dialogue that I was having a much harder time correcting than I thought. Mm. And ultimately, I finished the first one. It's not available yet. And I'm not even quite sure when it will be available. But I think in order to do it as professional as I want to do it, I'm actually going to have to take voice acting classes.
Okay, right.
If for no other reason than to figure out how to switch up dialogue between two characters more effectively.
Yeah.
Did not see that part coming, but that was actually a bigger hurdle than I thought it would be.
That's really interesting. I'm going to be doing a podcast episode with another author who has soundproofed a room in his house and recorded his own audiobook, but the audiobook is about him. He has leukemia, and it's about his journey.
Much easier, right?
Living with you. Yeah, so it's him telling his story. So in that
right.
sense, that's not. But I've never thought about when you're narrating fiction, that you have different characters and you have to, like you said, you can't just read it because.
No, you can't. It sounds reedy and.
Yeah. When you read a book in your head, you imagine the voices, don't you?
Absolutely. No, when I wrote the characters, when I wrote the characters into my books, I know how they look and how they live and what they think, and I know their personalities inside out. I really thought that part would be a lot easier. I really thought once I get to their part where they're talking, it would flow, and I don't even have to think about it, and I could be in the moment. All the way up until they started talking. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is Mose Gingrich's voice. This isn't Bruce's voice.
Oh,
this isn't Maria's voice, you know? And it just didn't sound authentic enough. And I'm not going to put something out there that's not good. Like that's not as good as it can be. So that part is going to be a little bit of a struggle, but I'll get to that. But when you're on the verge of publishing a book, you have to pick your poison. What are you going to spend time on?
Yeah.
And I had to ultimately stop with the recording for a while and focus on things that are more productive to the book right now.
Right. Yeah. So the first book's out. The second book is just about to come out in the next few weeks. Are you working on how many books are in the series? Yeah. Where are you at with the series?
The first series is going to have a minimum of 5 books, and depending on the reception by the fourth or the fifth book, I may just keep going. I have outlines for over 20 books in the future.
Wow.
And that this is not me bragging on myself. If there's something that I am good at, I have an unbelievably crazy vivid imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I can see something like I. It also helps that in my truck driving, I listen to a ton of audiobooks.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I listen to over 100 audiobooks a year.
Wow. Yeah.
And so I'll be listening to an audiobook and I'm like, that is such a great idea. I could totally take that one single idea and turn it into an entire book for myself in the future.
Mm.
And so I started listening to a book recently where the book starts out with a woman is in a coma. And everybody around her doesn't realize she can still hear and understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But she can hear her husband, and her husband is having cheating conversations in her hospital room. He's having a cheating conversation with his other lover, and she can hear and understand what's going on in her coma. But he obviously just sees a woman laying unconscious on a bed and doesn't realize she can hear it. An unbelievable opening to a book.
Mm-hmm.
Now take that plot and make it my own somehow and do backstory. Leading up to how the woman got there. And it's ridiculous how easy it is once you, if you have that kind of an imagination. In that, I am blessed. There are things that I really have to work hard on in my writing to make them good. But when it comes to actual plot and story and detail, those things I'm actually pretty good at. Like those things flow almost to, in fact, in my first book, when you realize that most books, when you realize most murder mysteries are 75 to 90,000 words, still sounds like a lot of content. 75 to 90,000 words seems like a lot. And so I just started creating characters and scenes and plots, and I ended up with way too many.
Okay. Yeah.
I had way too many plots. I finally started writing after I thought I had enough content to start writing. I just started writing. And pretty soon I was at 40,000 words. And yeah. I realized I haven't even started warming up to the main part yet. Like I said,
wow. Yeah.
And I had to just start cutting and cutting and cutting and cutting. And so, but yeah, no, I have outlines for a whole bunch of books. And I think what's going to happen is I'm going to do a minimum of 5 books in the first series and potentially 7 to 10. Mm-hmm. I think 10 would be a good number. And I'm writing one a year. I'm about halfway through my third book. And then, like I said, once I'm happy with where the first series has ended, then I'll reevaluate what do I need to do to make the second series better.
Yeah.
And I'll just create a new set of characters and start over.
Start again. Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask you, tell me if this is somewhere I shouldn't delve. Do you still have any contact with the Amish community that you grew up in? And what is the reaction of the community to what you're doing now with the books?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you're not, you can ask me any questions you want. And so these are obviously questions that get asked a lot. Mm-hmm. No, that was one of the reasons when I say I was 23 years old before I finally left the Amish. Understand that I knew at 12 years old, 11 and 12, that I was very unhappy in the community. I did not fit. I wanted to get out. I wanted more. I had way too creative of a mind for the Amish community. I wanted to create and do things exactly what I'm doing now. And it took me another 10 to 12 years from that point before I was finally able to get out. And part of the reason is I've probably talked a little bit negatively about some aspects of the Amish, but some of the good qualities of the Amish are things that you cannot find in the outside world. Mm-hmm. And some of those are family. Amish families are very strong, very close. They do take care of each other. As I described earlier, like my father, if I wouldn't have been able to make payments on my farm, my father would have picked up the payments and made the payments. I don't have that in the outside world. The Amish don't have things like health insurance or car, they don't have cars, but they don't have things like health insurance or homeowners insurance. So if your barn burns down or your house burns down, the entire community gets together and donates money and time and helps you rebuild. And there's almost no cost out of your own pocket.
Gosh, yeah.
I really
spirit. There is that
absolutely
spirit there, despite all the problems. Yeah.
I really miss that camaraderie and like the sense of community and people looking out for each other, people standing by each other. There's a lot of loyalty and trust between among the Amish communities, but even beyond that, they will excommunicate you from their church if you leave. And the part of the excommunication process is shunning those that have left and not having interaction with them.
Right.
So yeah, I'm not going to lie. That was one of the biggest reasons I didn't leave. Who wants to cut? There was 13 children in our family, Who wants to lose contact with 12 siblings forever?
And parents, and extended family. Yeah.
You cut an entire lifestyle that you spent the first half of your life. You cut that completely out of your life and you start all over from zero with no friends and you have to start a brand new lifestyle. And I think that's the reason a lot of Amish, there'd be a lot more kids leaving and that's why they do the excommunication and the scorning and the shunning is because they want to keep their youth there.
Right. Yeah.
But to answer your question, I've now been out for 20 years. I am married with 2 children and my 2 daughters who are 11 and 14 have not met probably over half of my siblings, half of my armor siblings. They haven't met him. They've met my mother one time at a public auction. And so no, there's no communication, and that's the way they prefer it. A little side note though, my father was very much against books and writing and anything creative. In fact, he would discipline me if I got caught reading a book. That was a waste of time. I needed to be farming and using my strength and being a man, you know, leave those no good, worthless books alone. But my mom liked books, and she would have to read them in secret because Dad disapproved of it. So she'd hide them like in the house and read them when Dad was working out in the fields. And I knew this. And although my mom never came out and publicly approved of my being a bookworm or reading books when I was Amish, she didn't tell me I can't either.
Right.
And just that little knowing my mom kind of had my back while she didn't really have my back.
Yeah.
That was enough that I was able to pursue that avenue. So since I've published my book, I sent the first book back to my mom. I mailed the first book to my mom. And it's been 6 months and I haven't heard from her. I'm sure she probably was a little shocked with the whole murder mystery thing. She probably probably wanted me to write about God, and I don't know what all she wanted me to write about. I'm sure she didn't expect murder mystery. but yes, I did send it back to her, and at some point I want to ask her what she thought of the first book, but I haven't had the opportunity yet so far.
Yeah, I hope she'll be proud of you for you know, that is such a huge thing to do, to literally give up your family, your home, your culture, your community, your entire upbringing, go off into the world and do what you want to do. And I hope that she'll be proud of you for you know, following your dreams and doing that.
So
it's against everything that you were
believe. She doesn't have a phone, so I can't text her and ask her how she
no email or
but as far as how difficult it was to leave, it was easily the most difficult decision I'll ever make in my life.
Really?
And anything since then has been a breeze. For a lot of people don't like change. You know, you've had one job and you're kind of comfortable in that job. People don't like switching jobs or pick about anything, like writing a book and publishing a book. That's a pretty big deal. Yeah. Like, even if the book never becomes a national, international, best-selling, smashing success, just sticking to it until you're done and not giving up. There are so many, I can't even imagine how many great authors out there gave up just a little bit too soon.
Because what
happens? What happens when you're writing and there's nobody there to push you and there's nobody there to motivate you? You hit a really rough patch where you can't find motivation to write or finish a chapter for 2 months, and you want to shelf it and just give up. Who's there to motivate you and keep you going? I think that's the biggest struggle with writers, is like, what motivates you? And it's sad for me to think how many great writers are out there that will never be discovered because they gave up just a little bit too soon.
Yeah, I had that myself. My first book, I started writing, and I think I got about halfway through, and then life got in the way, and I kind of, other things took priority, and I sort of got it into my head about, well, you know, who's going to read it anyway? What's the point? I'm just wasting my time doing it. And a good friend of mine said one day, what's happening with your book? And I said, well, you know, who's going to want to read it? And she said, who's not going to want to read it? Why are you letting that stop you? You know, just do it. And I was so really, so pleased that I had her on my side to just give me that little nudge. And that got me thinking, you know, if I like my book, there's got to be one other person that'll enjoy it. You know, it's,
if you have that one friend that is willing to encourage you and push you, brilliant. That is unbelievable. And I think just for my kind of to tie it back in with leaving the Amish, I don't know if I wouldn't have had to see, if I wouldn't have been able to leave the Amish and force my way through it and stick with it and make that determination and go through that whole trial of fire and brimstone, I don't know if I would have had the grit and the determination to write a book and stick with it. Like, but once you've left a culture like I did, anything's possible. At that,
I guess so. Yes, that's the toughest thing you could ever do in your life.
My whole motivation now is, I don't fail as a writer until I decide I failed. Yeah. Right. And you don't either. I don't care if your first book is barely average and your second book is worse or a little bit better. Until you put the pen down or until you put the computer down and stop trying, you've never failed. You may be 80 years old and laying on your deathbed and telling the words to somebody next to your deathbed, and it may still be a smashing bestseller, but you won't know if you give up.
Yeah.
Keep trying. Keep defining your craft. Keep doing what you're doing and try to get better and get more and more information and make it better and better. And I truly believe, I've said this several times, and the concept is something that people that haven't tried to write a book don't understand. I truly believe the people you and I know in the public spotlight, celebrities, movie stars, singers, rock stars, whatever, the ones that you and I know are the ones that just never gave up. Mm-hmm. They just kept plugging away and plugging away. Even when everybody else rejected them and said, you can't do it, they refused to give up. And that's why we know their names. Mm-hmm. Had they given up after the 10th or 20th rejection, we would not know their names.
No, that's true. Yeah, it is just keep going. If you want to do it, just keep trying. And you'll get there in the end. And yeah, like you said, only give up when you're at the point of wanting to give up.
And I think in order to do that, you have to be passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're not passionate about it, you will just give up regardless. No, mm-hmm. no motivating words you and I can say are going to change that. You have to be passionate about what you're doing to succeed.
Yeah, definitely. I agree completely. We have been talking for over an hour. It's been absolutely fascinating. Where can people find out more about you online?
Yeah, so I have my own website, www.amishinthecitymose.com. Mose spelled M-O-S-E. So amishinthecitymose.com is my website. I blog on there, and my books are listed there as well, besides Amazon. And and I have a newsletter there. So I've created a newsletter for people that are subscribed to me. I have a pretty, mm-hmm. pretty large following from my TV shows as well. And I send out monthly newsletters updating people on my writing and my TV stuff. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And same for you, Allison. It's great talking with you. And I'm very glad you had me on.
Yeah, I'm very glad to have had you on. And considering this is your first ever podcast, I think you're obviously a natural podcast guest, I think.
I wonder, I got to pick your brain a little bit.
Okay.
I feel like I really talk more than most people do on podcasts. Like, don't you feel like usually you get more words in edgewise than you did today with me? Am I just too much of a talker here?
No, I think maybe I should cut this bit out. No, I mean, some people find it very easy to talk about what they love doing. And when that happens, I just like to let it flow. I didn't want to stop and interrupt you with questions because I was just so fascinated by everything you had to say. And some people are a little bit more reticent about talking and they maybe need a little prompt along the way.
Yeah, but I was thinking about it about halfway through this and I was like, I'll bet you this is the most lopsided conversation you've ever had on your podcast.
there'd be one or two that are similar, but no, it's been absolutely fascinating. It's been really, really great to get to know you. I wish you all the luck with the books and the series, and I'm going to go off to Amazon now and have a look and sign up to your newsletter.
Perfect. Absolutely. Let's do it again sometime, Allison.
Definitely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you to Mose for being my guest on the podcast today. You can find his books Shadows We Remain and Caroline Creek Chaos on Amazon, and there's lots more information about him on his website, which is www.amishinthecitymose.com, and Mose is spelled M-O-S-E. You can also find him on social media, and all the links are in the show notes. If you'd like to know more about me and how I work with authors, come along to my website, www.theprooffairy.com. You'll find details there of all my services, including author coaching, editing and self-publishing packages, and dedicated writing sessions. This has been a Proof Fairy production in collaboration with my dogs, and I'll be back next time with another inspiring interview with another amazing author. Bye for now.